It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. After you've spent a certain amount of time outdoors in Alaska, camping or staying in public use cabins, it's easy to imagine how nice it would be to have a home out there in the wilderness. Maybe just a cabin, or maybe a place to live and experience the freedom and independence of a pioneer. On today's show, we're looking at that dream and how to make it a reality, along with the pitfalls and hardships that go with the fantasy of owning your own piece of Alaska. In the first segment of today's show, we'll talk about getting state land. There isn't any free land left anymore, but the opportunity to choose your own parcel and stake it is still available from the state of Alaska. Next, we'll talk about buying remote property and the practicalities and costs of getting something you can really use. Finally, I have a wonderful conversation to share with you that I recorded recently in Halibut Cove with an old friend who lived the wilderness dream for 5 years in the 1970s, before technology had taken a few of the edges off the challenge. My first guest today is Lauren Ruin, who is with the sales team at Department of Natural Resources. And state of Alaska owns a lot of land, right? When we became a state, we got 100 million acres of land. A lot of it is parks, a lot of it is different things, but some of it is just state land that's kind of available for people to settle on, right, Lauren?
That is correct. And actually, we haven't even gotten all of our land from the federal government yet.
Oh, well, it's only been 50 years, so.
Right.
Yeah, so. Let's start actually with the philosophy behind this. I mean, I think everyone knows the homesteading era in America was this idea of we're going to give land away to settlers who will move west, and that's going to settle the west. And there was a homesteading era here in Alaska too, and a lot of the subdivisions we live in Anchorage were originally homesteads. What's the philosophy of the program that you have now to get land out to the public? Sort of, what's the purpose of it?
It is still sort of the same idea. The Alaska Constitution says that we should make land available for settlement to settle the state of Alaska because it is such a huge area. And so it's the same idea now to get land out to individuals and give them an opportunity to, recreate in our beautiful state.
Mm-hmm. And how much land is kind of put forward for that purpose?
It depends. Currently, we try to offer somewhere around 250 parcels a year through our annual auction. And we do our remote recreational cabin sites program usually every other year. And I would say we try to offer around 200 authorizations for that program as well.
And do you feel like that kind of meets the demand in terms of how many people have this dream wanting to get? Because you can also go out and buy a piece of property from somebody who's already got it, and we're talk about that in the second half. But this is sort of the option of being like the first person on the land.
Right. That's a good question. I think in recent years, sales have not been as high. And this year, actually, we've seen an uptick. And the number of parcels that we have available over the counter, which is available for anybody to purchase at any time, you don't have to be a resident or anything like that, has been dropping, and it's kind of made us nervous that we may run out. So
run out? What do you mean?
Well, we have to offer land.
It's a pretty big state.
That is correct. There's a pretty long process to actually getting to sell a piece of property. We have to go through an area plan process to determine that an area is appropriate for settlement. And that is done by a separate section within DNR. After that's complete, we move to a decision process where we actually propose a subdivision or a remote recreational cabin sites project area. And that has to go through public notice. And after that decision process is complete, we can then move forward. So with our auction and OTC parcels, we're dealing with land that's already surveyed. So we would move forward to the survey and appraisal process. So that's something that takes several years.
So you have surveyors that you send out there, and they say, well, this would be a good parcel. We survey it, and then you appraisers to figure out what it's worth, and then you put it up for sale, and somebody can just walk into DNR and say, I'll buy it.
Right. And actually, the way that works is we offer parcels in our sealed bid auction first, and that's open only to Alaska residents. And then anything that does not sell through that auction becomes available through our over-the-counter sales.
Right. Okay, so that's one program. You mentioned the recreation cabin program. How does that one work?
The Remote Recreational Cabin Sites Program, we usually call Remote Rec for short, it's quite a mouthful. That program offers an opportunity to individuals that are also Alaska residents in this case to stake a parcel within a specified project area. Each project area is a certain number of authorizations, and there are very specific guidelines for that project area.
When you say stake, we're talking about like go out, tramp around in the woods, figure out where you want your cabin to be, and then just like an old-time pioneer, figure out where the corners of that property are going to be and pound stakes in the ground or somehow mark where it is.
Absolutely. They individuals that stake have to put a corner post in the ground or, you know, cut down a tree, do something to designate the corners that they want for that parcel.
So this is like Pa Ingalls in Little House on the Prairie, basically.
Yes. And they also have to do work to brush and flag the lines between those corners. So it's very clear to anybody else that comes out that this is the parcel that that individual has chosen.
I see. So and then they file some paperwork they're not buying it, they're just sort of homesteading it, or how does that work?
At that point, they do provide us with a lease application.
Uh-huh.
And after that point, after we lease the parcel to them for 3 years, and during that leasing period is when we are doing the survey and appraisal of the property. After that work is complete, we offer them the opportunity to purchase the parcel. They also have an opportunity to extend their lease for 5 years. That's a one-time opportunity, at which point they would have to move forward to sale.
I see. So is there a standard fee for the lease?
The price or the rental fee for the lease depends on the specific area. So there is a flat $100 a year fee that we charge. But that fee is also determined by the estimated cost of the survey and the estimated cost of the appraisal. So if we're talking a particularly remote area, that lease fee may be higher because we expect the survey costs to be higher.
Huh. So, but in essence, you're not going to know what you're paying for this parcel until the survey is complete and the appraiser has been out to look at it, and then you're going to get a price from the state, and then you're going to say, yeah, I'll buy it, or no, I won't. Is that true?
Somewhat. You won't know the final price, but at the time that we offer the Remote Rec program, when we first put out our brochure and say, these are the areas that we're offering, come and apply for an authorization now, we do have estimates. So we do have estimates of how much the survey will cost. And we also have our appraisers on staff do a base appraisal to give people an idea of how much a parcel of a certain acreage with certain amenities would cost.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have some rough ideas to start.
Well, what's the least somebody could spend on like a 5-acre recreational parcel that they go out and stake and go through this program? And what's the sort of some of the lowest prices you've seen, and then maybe an average?
I would say $3,000 to $5,000 would be the lower end.
For 5 acres of land?
Yes, that would be for a smaller parcel.
Uh-huh.
And they go up from there. I couldn't say exactly how much.
So we're not talking about waterfront property that's like the most desirable spots in Alaska. I mean, a lot of these places are kind of way the heck out there, right?
Some of them are. So if we take a look at the areas that we offered in our most recent offering in 2014, we did have parcels near Dillingham on Snake Lake, and you could stake waterfront parcels that you could boat right up to.
Huh.
We also offered the Tatalina Project area, which is near Livengood, right along the Elliott Highway. So you could just drive up and pull over, get your ATV out, and ride out to your parcel.
Uh-huh. And then describe some of the more remote spots that you put up.
So one of the most remote spots, I would say, that we offered this past year was the East Fork Pass Project area, which is about 50 miles from Nome along the Nome Council Road. We also offered the Half Cabin Lake Project area, which is out really in the middle of nowhere between Port Allsworth and Lyme Village along the Mulchatna River. And that one's pretty difficult to get to.
Yeah.
We also offered, the last project area that we offered was Dillinger River, which is along the South Fork Kuskokwim, right there along the Iditarod Trail.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
What an interesting job. Do you go out to these places yourself?
I do get to visit some of them. I was out in the Tatalina project area last summer. I did not get to visit any of the other project areas from 2014, but I did get to go and hold some of the public meetings that we had. So I got to visit Iliamna and Dillingham.
And that's where you're going to the locals and saying, do you think this land should become private or should it stay public? I mean, is that sort of the decision that you're getting to hear from them?
Yeah. So those public meetings were held during that decision process, specifically during the public notice period for that decision where we're suggesting a specific staking area.
All right. So you told us about the over-the-counter sales and about the recreation staking. Are those the main ways for people to get property from the state?
Those are, other than the auction that I mentioned earlier, which sort of feeds the over-the-counter sales.
Right. And then there also be sales from sort of quasi-state agencies like the Mental Health Lands Trust and the University of Alaska. And in those cases, there's sort of like a circular put out, these are the properties we're selling, and people buy them through that. And that's different from DNR.
That is correct.
Uh-huh. And those lands are lands that they obtained because there was a land grant that was to support the university or support mental health. And so agencies are now managing those lands and trying to produce income for those entities, right? As opposed to you. You're not trying to produce money particularly. You're trying to provide land access.
That's correct. And we are special in terms of government agencies because our land sales program funds itself. So the land that we sell means that we can sell more land later.
Oh, interesting. So, going back in history, and you're pretty young, you've been doing this job for 4 years, but there have been a whole bunch of different programs over time. And there was one that's legendary that happened in the 1970s, which was the Mike Byrne Land Program. Do you know anything about that? Because I've heard these crazy stories about how it was sort of like on a particular day, if you got out to like public domain land and you staked your 5 acres and it was yours. And so there was this land rush of people running all over Alaska. It sounds like there have been mistakes made in the past. Perhaps they weren't that smart and you've got a much more organized process now.
That is certainly correct. We recognize that some of the previous remote or open to entry programs that we had were much more difficult. We also had prove-up options where you could pay a reduced price or get the land for free if you built within a certain amount of time.
That was true for a long time, yeah. And people would go out there and try it, and they'd find out this is way too hard.
And then they would lose their land.
Right.
And we hate to see that. And so we like to think that the programs we offer now give people better opportunities to actually get land.
Well, in this remote cabin staking program, is there, you said they do have to brush out the property lines. Or do they have any other things they have to do in order to qualify to buy the land?
They do have to provide us with a packet of information to sort of prove that they did all this work. But at that point, their work is complete. They are waiting on us at that point to do the survey and appraisal process. And then after that's complete, they have the ability to purchase the parcel, and then there's no requirements after that. They don't have to build on the parcel. They can use it for whatever purpose they like, to recreate or to live on.
I have so many more questions about this, about the type of people who are doing it and what land is actually desirable and where people are successful. And we're going to be talking more about that, but I want to let everybody know that you're listening to Outdoor Explorer. Our topic today is getting your own piece of Alaska. How do you get a site for a cabin, a place where you're going to go, or maybe you want to live in the bush and sort of have that wilderness dream or fantasy, perhaps, of being like self-sufficient out in the woods. My guest right now is Lauren Ruin, who is the sales team lead for land sales at the Department of Natural Resources, which has these programs that we've been talking about, where their purpose really is to put lands in the hands of the public. And later in the show, we're going to talk about obtaining private land. Lauren, it seems to me that I'm interested in the know-how of the folks who come in. There are so many stories that probably a lot of longtime Alaskans have heard about, the sort of the ideas that people have about how easy it is to go out into the bush and get your own spot. And certainly I have my own place on Kachemak Bay and spent a lot of time selecting it and talking to different people about, you know, what was good about property and what was bad. And there are certain things that you might not know until you've actually been out there for a while. What experience level do you see when people are coming into the desk and have this dream of getting some remote land? I mean, do you get people who like are totally naive that you kind of need to educate a little bit?
We certainly do. And we do provide educational opportunities. We hold staking workshops in a variety of locations before staking opens based on where we actually got applications. And we actually recently filmed one of our staking workshops and put it up on YouTube for people to access at any time during the staking period. But we do definitely see a wide variety. We have people that really just don't know much about the work that's involved. And we have people that are surveyors, so they're more familiar with what I would say the work that actually needs to be done to create a parcel.
So are people utilizing this program as sort of a means of speculating on land, get some land that they can later sell, do you think? Or is it more people want to just use the land themselves?
That's hard to say. There certainly are always people that are interested in that. But I would say for the most part, our stakers are dreamers. There are people that, you know, have this great dream of owning a piece of land in Alaska that they got to pick out themselves.
Uh-huh. So the criteria for picking a piece of land, folks might not know until they really have some experience, but access is super important. I know so many people have had remote land that they can't get to, or it's too expensive to get to, so they kind of stop using it. And water is super important, that you really can't live without water. And if you have to carry all your water on your back, you're probably not going to use your land very much. Do you guys think about those things when you're sort of setting these things up, or how does that play in, and how do you see people come in who don't really get how important those things are?
We certainly are considering what the access is going to be. That's part of our decision process, thinking through how people will get to the area, how complicated that might be. And water is one of those criteria as well. We're looking at quite a few different things as we look at a project area.
I imagine you get some sophisticated people who know exactly what they're doing and do a good job. You must also get some people who get in over their head or it doesn't work out for them.
We do. We have customers that have staked completely outside of the project area.
They didn't know where they were.
Yes. That certainly happens. We have people that think maybe they staked 20 acres, which is the maximum, but our calculations say they staked probably closer to 30.
Uh-huh.
And really, most of the applications we get are incorrect in some way. You have to, with your lease application, create a legal description, a meets and bounds description.
Oh, that's hard, yeah.
And I'm impressed when people get it even close, because you're trying to, you know, decide what angle you're looking at from one corner.
And you're smashing around in the bushes when you're doing that. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I'm really impressed when I get some of these. But even a couple degrees is off and has to be corrected. So.
Well, even if you're out on monumented property, it can be hard as heck to figure out where you are. And finding monuments is hard, and then figure out those angles and distances is hard. And if you're just out way in the middle of nowhere where there's no monuments, it seems like it would be close to impossible. Although the advent of GPS has to make it a lot easier.
It does, and that is something we rely heavily on. We ask people to provide GPS coordinates for the reference point they used, whether it was an existing monument or some topographical feature. And usually we end up adjusting the meets and bounds description they've provided us based on those GPS coordinates.
And you're really trying to avoid some of the mistakes in the past where even in Anchorage, there, up on the Rabbit Creek area, I guess it was, there was a homestead that was platted and the property was platted completely wrong. And so many, many years of effort to get it figured out right. You're trying not to repeat those mistakes.
Absolutely. Certainly one of the reasons we have the remote rec program now as opposed to some of the previous programs is because we, as the state, do all the surveying ourselves. So any of these mistakes that we find, we are able to fix through the survey process.
Uh-huh. So folks might make these mistakes, but then it gets resolved, and then they get into this lease period, and then maybe they find out, yeah, I like this property, I do want to develop it. Or do they sometimes find out, wow, this is harder to get to than I thought, there's not enough water, or I didn't choose the right spot? I mean, does that sometimes occur?
That does. I certainly know of cases where people were really excited about where they staked and said, oh, I don't even have to clear any trees. And that was because it was swamp.
Right.
So that does happen. But really, we find that people that actually take the effort to go out and stake follow through with the process.
Because they've already got a lot of work invested.
Exactly. They've committed a lot to that. And often it's a family affair. They've had mm-hmm. friends or their whole family out there together. And so they really have a lot invested in it.
Yeah. Well, there's no free land. That's a thing of the past.
That is correct.
Yeah.
We do offer a discount to veterans that are Alaska residents. And that is about the only way you can get land at a reduced price.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. And I really appreciate your coming in. I think it's a wonderful thing that it still exists, you know, and that you can still do this. And that our state sort of supports it and has a program to make it happen. So, how can people find out more? Where is the information available?
Our website is landsales.alaska.gov, and then people can get more information there. We also are on Facebook and Twitter as Alaska Land, so people can search for us there and see what exciting things are going on.
All right. And we'll make sure to have those links on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just check out today's show, Getting Your Own Piece of Alaska. What if they want to come in face-to-face? Is it possible just to walk in, or should they make an appointment?
Absolutely. We have public information centers in Anchorage at the Atwood Building and in Fairbanks as well that people can just walk in and say that they're interested, and we can show them what we have to offer.
All right. Well, thanks. Lauren Ruin is the sales team lead for land sales at the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 8 on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is getting your own piece of Alaska, that dream that everyone has of living in the wilderness, or at least having a recreational spot, building your own cabin, and being out there, being a real Alaskan. And we talked a little bit about getting property from the state of Alaska, and they don't really do homesteading anymore, but they have very inexpensive parcels, and you can stake your own land. Most of us, I think, would probably buy something that's already been staked and that maybe already has a cabin on it, or maybe if you want to build your own, find some raw land that's available out there. So for this section, I'm going to be talking with Scott Connolly, who's with Bay Realty here in Homer, and he has a lot of listings that are remote properties, raw land, and knows a bit about land around Kachemak Bay and Kenai Peninsula. Thanks for being with us, Scott.
It's my pleasure.
So folks come in thinking that they want a cabin, and maybe they see, wow, these cabins are really expensive. Maybe I'll just get some land and build it. Do you find yourself counseling people about like what's practical and that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. I spend a lot of time educating people. I get an awful lot of phone calls and emails from people, especially with the big growth in the TV shows about Alaska. People are down south dreaming about this type of lifestyle. And they'll call me up and say, well, you know, when are they going to put a road into this property? And the answer is nobody's ever going to put a road into this property unless you want to pay for it. And so a lot of people have a lot of misinformation about what it takes to actually live even just a mile or two off the road. They don't realize exactly how difficult it can be.
So the factors you're looking at when you're thinking about a piece of remote property and what it's worth and how it can be used, I guess number one would be access. And around here, I mean, you can get to a lot of these properties by boat, but you need a boat then or water taxi.
Well, sure, especially across the bay. And I do a lot of across the bay stuff, as you know, and also a lot of stuff out towards Caribou Lake, going up to the Caribou Hills up in Nanilchik, which is the majority of our remote stuff around here.
How does the value of property differ between something that's like waterfront or lakefront as opposed to something that's, you know, half a mile back?
Huge variation in property values, just even in different places across the bay or near Caribou Lake. Of course, you get a piece of property on the lake. It's quite a bit more valuable than stuff that's off the lake. And a lot of it has to do with what is the access like. You can have two very similar parcels, one of which you can get to, it's close to an existing trail, and another one that you've got to cross some ravines and an undeveloped trail, and that's a whole nother ball of wax.
And you can't necessarily, I mean, there's always some kind of access, right? I mean, there'll be a section line or something like that. It has to be have some kind of access for it to have been platted with the government.
Yes, that's a qualified yes. A lot of the property, again, out by Caribou Lake, the only access to it is across state land. There's no, it doesn't necessarily have a section line easement or a platted right-of-way, but the state has what they call generally allowed uses, and that includes four-wheelers and snow machines. However, if you're heading out there in the summertime and you're using an ATV and you're tearing up some wetlands, you're not supposed to do that. And so a lot of this access that people think they have is really illegal because you're destroying wetlands getting there, and that's not going to go on forever.
Right. So how did this land come to be in private ownership? There must have been some program in the past, and so can you sort of look at the patterns out there and know sort of when things became private and how they became private?
Well, sure. And Alaska's, there's been a lot of different avenues that Alaska's had over the years for putting property into private ownership. The state would go out and actually create subdivisions, which they did out by Caribou Lake, and they platted them themselves and then sold them off and auctioned them off. And then they also had the staking program where you could basically go out and stake. My understanding around here, it was mostly 5-acre parcels. They'd open up an area to staking, and there's a lot of this out by Caribou Lake as well. You go out, stake your 5 acres, submit your drawing, and they go out and survey it, and you'd pay a few $1,000 and you'd end up with a chunk of dirt for very little money. A lot of effort, but very little money.
And so then they'll put that on the market, but it's not like people got super rich that way, because really remote land, I think you were saying earlier, doesn't necessarily go up in value really fast.
It doesn't. And again, there's a real mix there, because there's some beautiful pieces of remote property that are worth a lot of money for one reason or another. They're on a lake, they're dry enough to have a runway on them, etc. Looking at the property out by Caribou Lake, you know, those are all 5-acre pieces for the most part, except for the private subdivisions that were on the lake itself. And no, those values just haven't gone up that much. And it's primarily a function of supply and demand. There's an awful lot of undeveloped lots out there that people aren't using, and they're perfectly happy to sell them. So the prices just don't go up that much.
So if you're, I'm a young person, I want to get a site, build my cabin out in the woods. Can you still get a piece of land for $5,000, $10,000?
Yes. Somewhere in that range. Five is probably difficult to get something that cheap out there, but getting something under $10,000 is, there's property listed for under $10,000. So even if you paid full price, you're getting it for under 10.
Yeah. So when somebody comes in and they want to look at remote property that does not have road access, how do you go about showing it to them? You know, I've heard so many stories over the years of people buying property and they didn't even, they looked at the wrong piece of property, right? Or they didn't know exactly where it was, or they even build a cabin in the wrong spot, right? You, there's a million stories like this in Alaska. So how do you go about doing that? Because, I mean, you're in an office, you're a businessman. You can't be flying around all over the place, I wouldn't think.
No, I've been in planes and been in helicopters looking at property, but that's pretty rare. And you're absolutely right. I mean, people have bought the wrong piece of property, didn't buy, you know, they were buying something different than what was actually for sale. So I really do not like selling property that I haven't been to with the client. But that depends a lot upon the client as well. There's a lot of people that really know their way around out in the woods. If confidence level's high, great. But it's very difficult to make that confidence level high enough without actually being there with them. And it's a problem. Again, going back to Caribou Lake, people are like, okay, I want to go look at this piece of property. And I'll basically say, well, you want to know something? We're going to wait till it's wintertime so we can hop on a snow machine and actually get there in less than a day. It's much easier to show property in the wintertime out there than it is in the summer, for the most part.
Whereas on Ketchumac Bay, much easier in the summer than the winter, but you need a boat and, yes, and some time to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, across the bay stuff, it's you want a lot of delusions about what it takes to live across the bay, and people don't realize we were talking about a source of water, fresh water. People don't realize how important that is to have available. And moorage, that's the other thing that I coach people on a lot is, you know, why is this piece of property so inexpensive? It's like, well, it's exposed. You can't, you're not going to be able to park a boat there in bad weather, and they don't understand how important that is.
So it's important to, I mean, it's something like camping or any other outdoor activity. If you're going to live sort of out in the wilderness, you have to know something about how to get there and how to keep your boat safely and how to get your water and how to provide for yourself. There's nobody there to take care of you.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't realize how difficult that is. You know, they have this perception or this dream about living out in the Alaska wilderness and being able to hunt and fish and kind of live off the land, and which is all doable. But it's a lot tougher than people think.
Yeah, probably a good idea to start out with a state parks cabin or renting a yurt or something like that and make sure you really like it.
You go camping on state land. You can camp on state land anywhere.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. I'm with Scott Connolly. We're here in Homer at Bay Realty, where Scott's a real estate agent and he handles a lot of remote property. And so we're learning about getting your own piece of Alaska. And we're on the web at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show, Getting a Piece of Alaska, and you can find some links and resources to what we're talking about. So one of the things that I've noticed is that people have a hard time figuring out what property is worth when it's, I mean, if it's in a subdivision in the city, there are comparable properties that have probably sold. But if it's out across the bay or out, you know, out in the woods, there may not be anything nearby that's sold in quite a while, and it can be sort of hard to figure out what it's really worth. Is that a challenge that you face a lot?
Absolutely. And it just depends upon the particular piece of property, but just for reference, even properties in city limits, when you're trying to put a price on them and talking to appraisers, trying to put a value on a piece of property to make a national bank or the federal loan, they don't like the fact that we have to use older comparables than the rest of the country. We just don't have a market that's moving fast enough to meet those requirements. So we have to use older comparables than the rest of the nation does. We have to use comparables that are further away geographically than the rest of the country does, because this is Alaska and things are slower and further apart from each other. But especially across the bay, because you may have a piece of property that's, you know, quite valuable. It's very special, but there's nothing else like it. And so it's difficult to get stuff across the bay, comps across the bay.
So from your perspective, when you're looking at something and developing an opinion of what something is worth, what are the factors that you're looking at in terms of what would raise or lower the value? And I guess, I mean, some of them, I guess, would be obvious, but I'd like to sort of hear what sort of the thought process you go through.
Sure. Well, you know, if we're talking about remote property, access is huge, whether it's out of Caribou Lake or across the bay. There's properties, as you well know, that are very tidal over there, and you just flat can't get to them at a large part of the tide sequence. So that's a factor. And again, across the bay, if you got a piece that's got some kind of beach or some kind of easy access where you can at least get a foothold to have a staircase start, that helps. And again, talking across the bay, deep water moorage. If you got a place to do a running line or a dock or something like that, that adds a lot of value. Of course, the first thing that comes to mind when you're talking about property and Homer and values is the view. Of course, you get across the bay, pretty much everything has a nice view.
Steepness and water access, I would think, would be important.
It's nice to, if you got a source of fresh water, absolutely. And they did most of the stuff out by Caribou Lake. The state subdivision, they did a really nice job on. They ran them along ridge lines. And so most of those are actually decent, usable pieces of ground. They didn't subdivide up a bunch of wetlands. So those are all pretty good. And even the private subdivisions around the lake, again, most of it's pretty good dirt. But getting there's the hard part.
So if somebody's thinking about, wow, I really want to have my own piece of Alaska, what's step one in your opinion? I mean, is it get on the web and sort of start looking at different things and kind of and maybe get out there and make sure you really like it? Or what would be the process you recommend?
I talk to a realtor first and foremost and just explain, you know, what are your needs? What do you want to get out of this? I see it all the time that people purchase recreational properties and then they don't use them. And if you're not going to use them, there's not much sense in buying them. So yeah, figure out, you know, how much time you're going to be able to commit to actually utilizing the piece of property. You know, make the decision, do you want to be getting on a boat to go across the bay or hopping on a snow machine to go out to Caribou Hills? And again, talk to a realtor because talk to somebody who's got some local knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And if you're going to build a cabin, unless you're pretty handy and you've already done it, it may be a bigger task than you know and may or more expensive because getting the materials out to your site could be challenging.
It is. And having built a cabin out by Caribou Lake myself, which still isn't finished after many, many years.
Is there ever a cabin that's been finished?
I don't think so. Not a one. it's very time consuming.
The other option obviously is buying a cabin that's already there. Cause I don't know, are there people, contractors who build remote cabins? Is that really a business?
There are, but it's not a real big business. Mm-hmm. There's a few around that do that kind of work. But most everybody's building their own and bringing in their buddies to help them. And I will say that some very generous, helpful people helped me with my cabin who are professional contractors, and it was much appreciated.
Yeah, well, I've done quite a bit at my place too, and I think if you enjoy it, it's great recreation because you create something, you got to think it up and make it come to life. And I've had many people come out and help me, including engineers who told me how to do the first step and the second step. But it doesn't go fast because you've got only so much time you can be at your place, and you don't want to work, you know, all day long. And so it goes very, very gradually, but it is very rewarding.
I would agree with you. And I'm currently frustrated because it's like, boy, yeah, I would really like to finish this cabin. So all I have to do is come out here and relax. Cause now every time I go out there, I feel like I have to do something cause it's unfinished. So I'm looking forward to the day that I can just go out there with nothing but the jacket on my back and just relax.
Well, where I got to was that I had more projects and I was adding and I was adding, and then I realized that I had to go back and maintain and repair the things that I'd already built. So I think I'm at steady state now. The relaxation part never comes.
Yeah, well, I'm so, looking forward to it coming.
All right. Well, thanks, Scott. This has been interesting. I really enjoyed it. I didn't know I was going to get the bonus of having a TV star be with me today. Scott Connolly with Bay Realty. Thanks for being with me today.
Thank you very much, Charles. It's good talking with you.
Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. Find Outdoor Explorer anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. We're also available online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're back. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is getting your own piece of Alaska. So I am here in Halibut Cove, which is across Ketchumak Bay from Homer, and talking to one of my old friends who has a lot of stories about getting your own piece of Alaska. We're actually sitting on a float house, which is a house on top of a barge floating out next to Ismailoff Island in Halibut Cove. And my guest is Don Darnell, who grew up in Kodiak and spent a life at sea, and also is quite a carpenter and imaginative builder of things, and got to know him through a cabin he built near Bear Cove, where I spend my time in the summer now. And Don, how did you get that place originally? How did you get that land back in, it was like mid-70s, right?
Yeah, it was, let's see, probably around 1974. And this fella I'd known for about 4 years. He and I had gone to school together, a little private college together, and he was always going on about Bear Cove. And a bunch, he was from Anchorage, and a bunch of him and his buddies, they all came down and staked out open entry land in the, probably around 1970.
And that was like a program where you could get 5-acre parcels from the state just basically for staking them?
Yeah. Yeah, the state would designate areas where they wanted people to kind of settle. There were the ones that I was aware of were in Resurrection Bay, and then in Bear Cove. I had actually come up to Bear Cove in I think 1970 with a friend, and we were aware that almost all the land in Bear Cove had already been staked. So we hiked up to this lake, which everybody called Lake Kichigumi. It was about a mile from the coastline. And we looked around for a place to stake up there, but it was just too hard to get to. So, but then my buddy, Ron Downing, he kept going on about Bear Cove, and so when we came back from school, we went back to work surveying on the pipeline, and he ran into a gal that had staked out some land up there, and she told him she wanted to sell it, and it was supposedly 5 acres. Most of the, you know, the way the program went was you go in and you staked out your land, and then you came back and you registered it with the state. And then at some point, you had 5 years to get it surveyed. So you'd hire somebody to come out and survey it and submit that to the state. And then you would pay the state the assessed value of the land when it was staked out, which was very little. In my case, it was very little. And so anyway, this gal...
And you say very little, like a couple $100 or something, or a $1,000?
$500 for 5 acres.
Yeah. My buddy... told me about this gal, so I sent him a check, $500. I said, here, you make a down payment on for me till I can have a look at the land. And she took it as full payment, so I had 5 acres sight unseen. And of course later I had to have it surveyed, and then I had to pay the state gee whiz, I think it was just a few $1,000. And along with the survey and I think it all came to about $5,000 with the surveyor and everything. And so, still, it was pretty cheap.
And you went out there and lived on it?
Yeah. Yeah, I went out and had a look at it. And then figured out, you know, I mean, at that point in my life, I think I was like maybe 25. I had never built anything. And so I gathered up some logs from a friend that was milling up two-sided logs out in Anchor Point. And then I tore down, I was living up in Fairbanks at the time, I tore down an old house up there and salvaged all the lumber and borrowed a flatbed and drove it all down to Homer and paid a guy $100 to tow it all out to Bear Cove and leave it on the beach. And then I think I had a chainsaw and a broken folding ruler and some hand tools, a brace and bit, and some hammers and saws. And that was it.
And just some imagination, and like you had no plans, And the place you built, like this octagonal log cabin, it with dormers and an octagonal roof, like, it defies the imagination, like how you could have ever come up with it.
Well, you know, back in those days, you go around Homer and you look at a lot of the homes from back in those days, and they're all, you know, a bunch of hippies doing their back to earth thing. And that's what we were all doing up there, and nobody really knew what they were doing. And you see a lot of very eclectic looking places. And I had a rough drawing, and I think it was, I figured out that on an eight-sided structure, each wall was going to be about 6 foot long. And so I built a door that was one wall. And I had some windows that I got out of an old hospital up in Fairbanks. And kind of the place was built around the door and the windows. And then when it got time to put the roof on, you know, there was some head scratching, and it wound up being an eight-sided roof, which in the end turned out to be quite a challenge. And
instead of trusses, you used like tree branches that you found out in the woods or something.
Yeah, poles. You know, skinned the poles and put them up and found a center post to lean them all against till they were all in place. And then decided I needed a dormer. So then there were four dormers. And that was probably the hardest part, was because there were... Yeah, there were no plans. It would just hold a pole out there and support it with something and then stand back and look at it and then cut some more poles. But getting up on it and putting tar paper on it and shake shingles, that was difficult. And I actually fell off the roof once, and if I'd have just fallen off and let myself fall into the moss, that would have been great. But I happened to catch hold of the eave right as I went over and tore up my rotator cuff pretty good.
So that's a story that you told me about trying to get back to Homer.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Right, yeah. That was... I didn't know what I had done. I had run out of coal, and I had a lot of wood that I could have chopped up, but it was all frozen, and it was really hard to do it one-handed. And I couldn't sleep because of the pain, so I decided to go into Homer and see the doctor.
And just to orient people, you're like 13, 14 miles away from Homer on the far side of the bay, completely by yourself in the wintertime. You're really, I mean, it's sort of wilderness stuff, and there's no radios and no cell phones. There's no way to tell anybody what you're up to.
No, there wasn't. So, yeah, but, you know, a lot of us had old-time dories in those days with little diesels and... So it was a 2-hour trip to town, and then it just happened that it had been real cold for a long time, so there was a lot of ice built up in front of the spit, in front of the harbor. The harbor was full of ice, and so I couldn't get through it in my little boat, so I sat there all day waiting for a larger boat to come along and tow me through, and that never happened. It was getting late, so I motored back over to Halibut Cove, where I knew some folks, and they put me up for the night. And the next day, Clem Tillion had the pilot boat come over, because that was a steel boat. It could make it through the ice. And they fetched me and took me into the harbor, and then I went up and saw the doctors, and they said, well, there's nothing we can do. They gave me some aspirins, and I just let it heal up.
So you're pretty much living out there year-round and living kind of something that nobody really does anymore, because we have communications, we have faster boats, we have a lot of technology now. When you look back on that, that must be a really nice part of your life to think about.
Yeah, it wasn't because I was so young. You know, I was, like I said, I was about 25, 26 when all this was going on, and I lived there for 5 years, and then I would go away seasonally and work either surveying or on ships, and it was lonely out there. In the summer, there was probably a dozen of us out there, and so that was a lot of fun. We had a lot of get-togethers, campfires, parties, and stuff. And most of the guys had girlfriends, or they were starting to get married and stuff, and so they would all leave in the fall. And as you know, that spot is exposed to the northeast, and so it was pretty difficult. But it was lonely, and every time I would come back from working and then move back out to Bear Cove, it was a matter of getting used to that, being totally alone again. And it was really alone. So I would make it on the first, it was kind of a pattern where the first time I would go out there, I would make it about 2 weeks, and then I would go back into town and get grub and fool around with friends and stuff, and then spend a few days in town, go back out, and then I'd spend a month, and then go back to town, and so it went on and on like that, where each time I could stay longer until it was not a big deal anymore. But I realized that when you say you're going to be alone, most people don't really fathom what you're saying. And most people have never been in a position where there is no input other than nature, which is really plenty. You're hearing, you're seeing, you're smelling, everything gets more acute. And I had a friend, just as an example, I had a friend that came to visit me, and she would come every year, and I would bring her out, and she'd bring all her own fishing gear and her cannon jars and her and everything, she'd spend a week or two, and we'd have a good time, and then I'd take her back, and she lived in Anchorage too. The one time she came out, my father had just gotten hurt, so right about time she arrived, so I said, okay, I'm going to take you out there, and with all your gear, I'll leave you this little rowboat, which was like an 8-foot pram, and I'll have my buddy Zip come out and pick you up in a week. He'll have my boat. So I went down to see my dad, came back up, called Zip. I said, well, did you go out and get Ann? And he said, no, she came back on her own. And I said, well, I don't understand. He said, well, she made it for about 3 days. And then she decided to row that little 8-foot pram to town.
She survived.
Yeah. Yeah. She said she would row for a while, and then she'd lay down in the bottom of the pram and rest for a while, and then she'd row some more. Fortunately, it was not a big day breeze.
Wow.
And she was almost to town when one of the local characters here in the cove, Steve Nathanson, he came up on the pram thinking, oh boy, I found a pram. There she was sleeping in the bottom. And then he gave her a ride.
So you were out there for 5 years, and then at some point you decided you weren't going to be there anymore. Tell me about that decision. Did you just like sort of turn away and leave it behind?
Well, that was kind of a beautiful experience because, you know, in my life there's been few decisions that were so easy and so clear to make. And I was sitting there on the porch one day, right where, you know, I showed you where I used to sit on the corner of the, overlooking the cliff, and looking at my dory and watching the cliff on the other side, and it was like an epiphany. I had been down visiting people in Halibut Cove, and I had a lot of friends my age in those days. You know, I was 35 years ago. There was a lot of people my age in Halibut Cove, and so I was thinking how cool that was, and it just came to me like an epiphany that, and I can still hear the words. It was like, okay, I've done my pioneer trip. That part's over. And I packed everything I wanted to take with me into my dory, and I left. Only came back to visit once in a while.
Did you get everything out of that part of your life that you expected to?
Yeah. Yeah, I learned a lot out there, and with very little technology. And then when I moved here to Halibut Cove, I learned a whole new set of technology. And there were neighbors.
Yeah.
There was like 20 of us.
A real metropolis.
Yeah. It was great. It was great. And I put together a little makeshift floating house on an old barge that I'd found sunk and refloated it and pushed a little shack on it. And it was like here in this protected spot where then I wasn't nearly as exposed as I was in Bear Cove, and I could actually spend the whole winter without getting driven out by the wind and the storms, and I was really happy here.
Well, I'm really glad you pioneered our little cove, which we call Swallow Cove now, down by Bear Cove, and it's a special place, and we really love it. And thanks for telling us about it, Don.
You bet.
That's all for today's show. I want to thank each of our guests, Lauren Ruin of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, Scott Connolly of Bay Realty and Homer, and Don Darnell, Halibut Cove resident who has lived a real Alaskan life. Join me next week at this time when our topic will be caribou. They still outnumber people in Alaska. We'll learn about the biology of our huge Alaskan herds and the adventure of hunting for caribou. Outdoor Explorer is produced by Monica Gokey. Grace Bogine is our production assistant and helps with lining up guests. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.